So tonight's question is, why is the sky dark at night? And you will discover at the end, a fundamental property of our universe can be answered by thinking about that. There'll be a short quiz. So let's watch Alice and Bob.
Hey, Bob, I've been wondering why it's dark at night.
Because the sun isn't shining.
Yeah, but all the stars are shining. If stars are sprinkled everywhere in an infinite universe, there'd be a star in any direction we look. The entire sky would be bright like the sun.
Unless, for some reason, light from the really far away stars can't get to us, leaving gaps.
Or just hasn't gotten to us. Yet. Which would be true if the universe hasn't been around forever.
You mean the light from really far away stars, traveling since the beginning of time, might not have reached us yet?
Yeah. I wonder if the darkness at night is a clue that the universe had a beginning. That's a powerful idea.
Thank you. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Seth Lloyd.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you very much, Greg. And I'd also like to thank Sun Life. I want to know, since this lecture is going to be largely about photosynthesis, do you just fund this lecture or do you fund all the other lectures as well? Or do you just pick this specially? Or maybe we can get a little extra funding for this one. I'd like to thank Wyatt, who, when I was unable to buy a cupcake out there because I didn't have any Canadian dollars, donated generously $20 in order to get me a cupcake. Where are you, Wyatt? Can you raise your hand? Give him a hand. That's the kind of generous spirit we're looking for out here. So I'd like to thank Mike Lazaridis, Neil Turek, and the Perimeter Institute for having me here. I've been coming to the Perimeter Institute ever since it was just a little old Italian restaurant downtown serving indifferent food. And it's just doubled and doubled again. And I'd like to warn you, Mike, if you're here, I don't see him here, but if you're here, that if you double another 270 times, the Perimeter Institute will constitute all the elementary particles in the universe. Could be dangerous, but that new building is looking very nice out there. I think that, you know, it's a great honor to be here because PI is a fantastic place for research. I have been having a wonderful time talking with people here today. But I think the greatest honor I heard from an anonymous high school student, raise your hand, Patrick, who informed me that members of his class have been given free tickets to come here tonight so they could write about it in their class, but several of them were scalping them for $25 apiece. And since, you know, I don't feel bad because they're not here, right? I watch it, but actually they're probably going to watch it on the internet. So if you're out there, I just got to say, like, next time I want a piece of that action, okay? Okay, so today I'm going to tell you about quantum life. That's the topic of this talk. I'm not so good with it. I normally do talks on a blackboard. I'm against PowerPoint, which I regard as kind of a tool of Satan. Thank you. It's true. Like, you know, if life came in bullet points, it would be over by now. So I don't know how this is going to work with this document camera. I've used it before. Normally, I like to get up and like write on stuff. So I'll try not to write on the screen over there. So the title of this talk is Quantum Life. It's about how quantum mechanics plays an unexpectedly important role in living systems. Of course, you know, everything is quantum mechanical. Quantum mechanics is the theory of physics that describes things at their most fundamental level. So we're all quantum mechanical, you know, living things, dead things, everythings. But until very recently, it was thought that, well, okay, you know, chemistry is quantum mechanical, but living things are big, hot, wet, inimical environments to quantum mechanics. And, you know, we have these molecules, we can describe them pretty classically, like balls on springs bouncing around or like locking into each other and stuff like that. So it was thought until quite recently that the kind of like quantum weirdness, which plays an important role in things like quantum computing, which is my own field, played very little role in actual living systems. Then, about 3.5 years ago, a very beautiful experiment done by the Fleming group, Graham Fleming's group in Berkeley, showed that quantum mechanics and quantum coherence and quantum entanglement and wacky stuff like that was playing a very important role in photosynthesis. In fact, it was important for, it was what caused photosynthesis to be so efficient, the collection of light. And so I'm going to tell you a bit about that, so about photosynthesis in bacteria. I'll tell you how quantum mechanics plays this funky role. Then if I may not have time to cover all these things, but there's also a case where there's strong evidence that certain birds, in fact many birds, when they navigate, are using quantum effects in order to detect the orientation of the Earth's magnetic field. So this is called the avian compass, but I'm going to call it quantum bird brains for, for this. And then the final one, which I think for which there's indirect evidence where quantum mechanics is playing some funky role, is in the sense of smell. This is really actually quite hard to believe, but it is nonetheless the case. And the primary proponent of this theory is a wonderful fellow named Luca Turin. He was giving a talk at a recent conference on quantum biology that we organized at Harvard, and the title of the talk was, Is Smell Quantum? But when the chair got up to announce the talk, he said, Luca Turin will now talk about I smell a quantum. So that's the topic of the three topics I'm going to cover. I'm going to spend most of my time on photosynthesis, maybe a brief time on quantum bird brains, and then because I smell a quantum is just such a fun thing to talk about, I'll talk about quantum mechanics of smell. And I think one the I called I think this in the announcement for the talk, I called this. This kind of feature. Well, let me say why I called it. You may have read it, but let me say why I called it what I did. I'll tell you in just a second what I called it. So, you know, quantum mechanics is kind of strange, weird, and illicit in some way. It violates ordinary classical laws, and all of these things in quantum in life, when quantum living systems are using quantum mechanics, they're basically using it for what all living systems use stuff for, which is to have more sex. Right, or at least have more offspring, okay? So when you're using quantum mechanics to improve your ability to reproduce, I call this quantum hanky-panky. Quantum hanky-panky occurs when things are using quantum mechanics to get an edge up on their fellow living things, all right? And in fact, you can kind of see before I describe why quantum hanky-panky is out there, and it's probably many more places than we know, in retrospect, it's sort of weird that people didn't think that things like bacteria might be using quantum mechanics. Because, you know, if you're an organism that's reproducing, you know, and you can decrease your doubling time or increase your efficiency of reproduction by even 1%, then after 100 generations, you're the king of the heap or the queen of the heap. Assuming bacteria come in heaps. And in fact, these bacteria that I'm going to talk about are sulfur-breathing bacteria that live on the bottom of the ocean in hot water vents, where a photon comes by only about every half hour or so. So you can see the strong evolutionary pressure towards efficiency in these bacteria. Because, you know, here's the bacteria. Bacteria is like, I caught a photon. Thank God that finally the children will eat. Oh, shoot, I dropped it. Oh, no. Oh, you idiot. Oh, the children, you dropped the photon. The children will starve, right? So simply for, you know, for spousal relations amongst bacteria, it's extremely important to use any bit of efficiency that you possibly can. And as it turns out, these bacteria have become extremely sophisticated at developing quantum mechanical techniques. In fact, so here at IQC, they have. I was actually noticed with both a combination of dismay and pleasure that IQC has recently surpassed MIT is having the largest quantum information and computation group in the world. Congratulations. Good job, Raymond. Raymond Laflamme, raise your hand, please. Good. No, he's going back in his seat. Yeah, I said largest, you may notice. Oh. We can bring out the steel cage to discover which is best. So, for a long time, people like Raymond and I and our colleagues here at PI, at IQC, at MIT, and lots of places have been developing what we thought were really, really clever techniques for protecting and using information at the quantum mechanical level. Now, it actually turns out that things like bacteria and green plants have been using lots of these techniques all along. Things like quantum codes. A code is a device to protect information, and a quantum code is a device to protect quantum information. So these bacteria, as it turns out, as I'll show in a bit, these bacteria are actually using sophisticated quantum coding techniques to protect the energy that they get. So you don't have that terrible, oh shoot, I lost the quantum problem going on there. And you have good, you know, spousal relations with it. So, and they're also using quantum codes to help the transfer and make the transfer of that energy more efficient. So this is kind of nice for me, because for a long time when I'd go around giving talks about quantum computing, in fact, I think quite a long time ago now, I gave one of these talks about quantum computing at PI. Somebody in the audience, and I think somebody at this audience like 10 years ago or whenever this was, would raise their hand and say, you know, you can't possibly build a quantum computer, because if you could build a quantum computer, then nature would already have discovered a way how to build it. Now, this is a really dumb argument, you know, because first of all, we have built quantum computers, like that's one thing. And secondly, the same argument is like, you can't possibly build a laser, because if you could build a laser, nature would already have discovered how to build a laser. And this is, you know, that's very silly. I mean, actually, nature did discover how to build a laser, because nature discovered how to build human beings, and human beings are natural things, and human beings discovered how to build lasers, and so. You know, but now it turns out there's a much better argument against that, which is actually it's not so, because in fact nature, more than hundreds of millions of years ago, discovered sophisticated quantum information processing and coding techniques. Bacteria use them to this day, so do plants, and I'm going to tell you about them. Okay? All right, are there any questions at this point? Does anybody whom I heckled want to heckle me back? I like it when people ask questions. One of the virtues of not using PowerPoint is that you can ask questions and I can answer them, as opposed to having to try to code a PowerPoint answer to that. Yeah.
There's been talk on CPC about the impossibility of bees being able to outsmart computers to find the most efficient route from flower to flower, because they only have a million brain cells. And then there's, I think, Ruben has been studying how slime molds
yeah, I lived in New York in the 1980s. I know what you're talking about. It's not known. So, as I'll argue, so it's nature uses quantum effects when they're available, which is perhaps not surprising in retrospect. But it's hard to use quantum effects in living systems, because living systems are hot, wet places that are inimical to quantum coherence, as I mentioned before. So nothing is known about whether quantum mechanics plays a role there, though I'm sure that slime molds, being an ancient and honorable institution, are using quantum effects for something else. So, yeah. But one shouldn't, you know, maybe I should ask, say right now, so nobody asks me later. There are have been some theories that quantum mechanics plays an important role in the brain in terms of thought. But really, these theories are kind of along the lines of, wow, quantum mechanics is weird. We don't understand it. Wow, consciousness is weird. We don't understand it. Wouldn't it be cool if they were the same thing, right? And in fact, the theories that have been proposed by Roger Penrose and Stuart Hameroff have the feature that they're wrong and can be shown to be wrong right away. And so they should actually, you know, we shouldn't make fun of them. We should thank them for proposing a theory that can be falsified. So there's no evidence that points. No, it's true. That's how science is supposed to work. Why are you laughing? So I don't think there's any evidence right now that quantum mechanics is playing some role in the brain or in like honeybees talking with each other and stuff like that. You know, if classical mechanics will do the job, nature could use classical mechanics. All right, good. That was a good question. Are there other questions? Okay, let's go to the actual subject of the talk. Like, let's get in some details. So now let's look at photosynthesis. And let me describe to you how it works. I have a nice green pen here to describe photosynthesis. I should say that so what happens, I'm you know, one of the problems about not using PowerPoints is I can't download a whole bunch of things from Google Images and, you know, put them up and have them look really cool for you. So I'm going to sketch them in ways that look strange and confusing, which is maybe a better indication of how they are, because they are strange and confusing. But I should say that all the things I'm going to draw here, there are beautiful pictures of the elements of photosynthesis on Google Images. So I'll just put down the name. If you want to see it, go look it up there. It's Google Images is a great tool for this. Like, you go, wow, it really looks like that. So photosynthesis is a process whereby plants and animals like bacteria take light from the sun and turn it into usable chemical energy. It's a pretty amazing process. You know, there's sunlight coming in, it's got a lot of energy. And somehow this sunlight has to be turned into chemical bonds and things like sugars. How does that work? That's pretty remarkable. So what happens is photosynthetic complexes are called complexes for a reason, that they're complex. A typical one, and this is the one for, maybe I should draw it. This is for purple sulfur bacteria, so I'll draw it in purple. So it's got all these weird ring-shaped molecules LH2. And, you know, they're in some kind of they're embedded in a membrane in some funny way, not in a very regular way. And then there's a big set of rings in the middle, and in the middle of this is some funny set of stuff. And in here is what's called the reaction center. And this is where this action is going to take place. This is where the chemical bonds are going to be made. So when light comes in, and by the way, why are purple bacteria purple? By the way, I do object to that Alice and Bob thing, because I think that was quite a misleading explanation for why we don't see the night sky full of stars. It's really because the distant galaxies are very heavily redshifted, and so it's not because the universe is finite. The universe could be infinite. I don't know. Anyway, never mind. I object. J'accuse. But let me ask you a question. So why are purple bacteria purple? What color light do they absorb? I'm sorry? Not purple. That's right. That's the answer. They absorb stuff like, let's say, they absorb things that are, let's say, like bluish or reddish light that is not purple. So let's draw the right color, because they're purple because they reflect the purple light, right? Okay. So in comes a photon. This is a particle of light, a photon. And the photon creates a nice little exciton. So an exciton, I'm going to draw it. It's an exciton. I mean, it's kind of a cool name, right? You know, anything that has an on at the end, that's like a quantum particle. You know, photon, phonon, electron, proton. So an exciton is a little particle of excitement. Very, very, very apropos for quantum hanky-panky, if you think about it. So it creates this exciton, and the exciton is actually a little bound electron-hole pair. So it takes an electron. It pops it out of where it's sitting. The electron goes over here and it leaves a hole. The electron is negatively charged, the hole is positively charged. And these have a lot of energy, a substantial fraction of the energy in the original photon. Okay? They're actually, when I say they're about this far apart, it's not true. These are a few angstroms apart. All right. But this exciton somehow has to make it through this whole complex and get somehow eventually to here and get to the reaction center where it can be turned into chemical energy. Now, this process of hopping hither and thither through this complex, I don't know if you'll be able to see this. So this process is, the hopping process is 99%+ efficient. Now, not all photons are absorbed. Not all of the energy in the photon can make it into the exciton. Typically, you know, about 80 or 90% of it, maybe a bit more, actually. And actually, the reaction center is very inefficient, so the actual fabrication of chemical bonds from the energy in the excitons is only like 3 to 7% efficient, maybe 3 to 5% efficient. This, by the way, if you think that we're going to grow our way out of our energy crisis using biofuels, should make you think twice. Because, you know, photocells, even like commercial photocells, are already like, you know, 12 to 15% efficient in taking energy. And so even if you just get the biomass alone, that's, you've already lost more than 95% of the energy. I know that this is a place around here that they grow lots of wheat and stuff like that, but or corn, but you know, I'm sorry, that's, you've got to be careful about that. So, but this process, this transport process, is 99%+ efficient. And that's kind of weird, because if you just think, first of all, I actually even drawn this correctly, because you know, these excitons, I should say, each of these rings contains about, they contain 27 places where the exciton could be. These are called chromophores, which is Greek for something that carries color. So 27 places where the exciton could live. And then there are many tens of rings. So there are hundreds and hundreds of places that this exciton can hop through here. And if you just ask, if this exciton were kind of like to wander around randomly, you know, jiggle around in this ring right here, going sloshing back and forth, and then hop over this other one and slosh back and forth here, hop over here and slosh back and forth, it wouldn't have time to make it to this reaction center. It would decay. And then you get back to these, you know, bacterial spousal relation problems, you know, that you're losing the energy that comes in. This has for many decades been a big mystery about photosynthesis. How can this process be 99.5%+ efficient? Well, that was a question, people. Okay. The answer in this lies in, so how, let me just turn this over since these things are nice and thick. How can this be so efficient? Can this transfer process be so efficient? I bet you know the answer. Well, the answer is, of course, quantum hanky-panky, right? Quantum hanky-panky. So in fact, the answer lies in what we in quantum computation call a quantum algorithm, a way of processing information in a coherent fashion. Now, when the Fleming paper, I have a confession to make. Patrick will be shocked by this, but due to the defaults of the American education system while I was growing up, I never studied biology in my life, ever. Like, not even in kindergarten. I studied new math, and new math, by the way, which is like all about set theory and stuff like that, it's useless if you want to do your taxes, but it's very useful if you want to be a physicist, as it turns out. But I never studied biology. So 4 years or 3.5 years ago, I really knew very little about photosynthesis, except it's like this method for taking light from the sun and turning it into chemical energy. The reason I got involved in this field is that when this Fleming paper came out 3.5 years ago, there was an article in the New York Times that said, green sulfur bacteria are performing quantum computations. And we at MIT, we have a, even though we're smaller than IQC, we still have a rather extensive theory group consisting, well, I won't tell you all the famous people who are in it. No, sorry, Raymond. anyway, so we sit around, the way it works is we sit around and people say, is there anything we should talk about today? And somebody said, hey, it turns out that green sulfur bacteria are performing quantum computation. And we thought this was really hysterical. The prime feature of our theory group meetings that we have to break into hysterical laughter at one point, and this got things rolling right away. It's like, oh, that's the most crackpot thing I've ever heard. However, you know, the group seemed reputable, and so the way it works then is that we form kind of a posse, or like we make some deputies who are deputized to go and figure out what the heck is going on. So Alan Aspergusik, who is a professor of chemistry at Harvard, at that time he was assistant professor of chemistry at Harvard, he and I were deputed to go out and find out what the heck was going on. So what the Fleming group claimed is that this is that these bacteria were performing what's called a quantum search algorithm. Now, how does quantum search work? Well, let me actually just recap for people who are not intimately familiar with quantum computation how quantum computation works, right? So you know, in ordinary computation, you have bits. And a bit is a distinction between 0 and 1, yes or no, true or false, et cetera. But the way in your computers, the way this works, is a bit is a whole bunch of electrons that are over here. We'll call that 0. It's on a capacitor, right, which is like a bucket for electrons. So if the electrons are over here, the bucket is empty, and you call that 0. If the electrons are over here, the bucket is full, and you call that 1. Okay? And you flip bits by moving electrons on and off this capacitor. All right, who knew this before? All right, who didn't know this before? Okay, actually many more people knew this and didn't know. Who is in some weird quantum superposition of knowing this and not knowing this? It seems that there are a lot, because only like about a third of people raised their hands, right. Okay, so since I mentioned quantum superposition, it got a laugh, so some people must know what it is, okay. So, in a quantum computer, you can imagine miniaturizing this capacitor so that one electron over here is 0, one electron over here is 1. Okay? That's not hard to imagine. It's just like, you know, make things smaller, and eventually the capacitor contains only one electron when it's charged up. All right. So now here's where the quantum weirdness comes in. One of the strange and weird and counterintuitive features of quantum mechanics, which nobody really understands, okay? Like, it's just counterintuitive. We only understand it because we have mathematical theories that it's the case, and we have plenty of experimental evidence of the case. In fact, quantum mechanics is the best established theory that we have in terms of experiment outside, perhaps, of natural selection. Sorry, are there any creationists in the audience here? I don't want to offend people. It's okay. I mean, actually, like, once you see the design features I'm telling you about, you say, wow, that God, either you're going to say, well, okay, either God, she is one smart quantum mechanical engineer, or you could say, gajillions of bacteria did not die in vain. So, In a quantum bit, or a qubit as it's called. So when I was a kid, a qubit was the distance from here to there, right? But now like lots of things have changed, right? So a qubit is now a quantum bit, and in quantum mechanics, an electron can be both here and there at the same time. I don't ask me how that can be, but I just tell you that's the way it is, all right? So, and it is. I mean, electrons, not only can they be here and there at the same time, they're encouraged to be here and there at the same time. In fact, they like being here and there at the same time. It's hard to stop them once these bits get too small from being here and there at the same time. So in some weird quantum mechanical sense, you have a quantum bit that reads 0 and 1 simultaneously, okay? Now, that's different from ordinary classical bits, which either read 0 or read 1. So how does a quantum computation work? Well, one use for a bit in a computer is an instruction. So 0 can mean do this, like add 2 plus 2. 1 can mean do that, like add 3 plus 1. If you take a quantum bit or qubit that's in the state 0 and 1 at the same time, and you feed it as an instruction to your quantum computer will do this and that simultaneously. Like add 0, add 2 plus 2, add 3 plus 1 simultaneously, in some weird quantum sense that nobody really understands, okay? It's this kind of quantum multitasking that gives quantum computers their advantage over classical computers, because you can do not just 2 things at once, but 4 things at once, or 8 things at once, or a gajillion things at once. A gajillion is a technical term for a large number. And so it's by doing these many, many, many things at once that quantum computers can do, you know, a classical computer can only do one thing at once. If you do classical parallel processing, you have 2 computers that are doing 2 things at once. But a quantum computer, you have one computer that's doing two things at once, or four or eight, et cetera. And it's this kind of what's called quantum parallelism that gives quantum computers their power. I actually have to say that I really didn't understand this until I became a parent myself. And my wife is also a professor, and so I suddenly became an extreme multitasker. So maybe it inspired my work, I'm not sure, I don't remember. Okay. Okay, so what kinds of things can you do with this kind of quantum computation? Well, a famous example of this is Peter Shor's algorithm for factoring large numbers, which would allow you to break all the codes that people use to send information over the internet, which would be kind of a bummer because, you know, you couldn't buy stuff from Amazon.com any longer. So this is what would be a disruptive technology. Indeed, was in the United States, this work was funded by the Disruptive Technologies Office for a while. And I tried to get them to give us these like black hats that said DTO on this, but they never let us do that. So it's this, but another famous algorithm is quantum search algorithm. And the idea is like this. It's like, I forget which pocket I put my wallet in. Is it there, 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 there? You know, if you try and look for your wallet, then the classical search method is you look around till you find it. And if there are 10 pockets it could be in, then you have to look on average 5 different places where it's going to before you find it. Now, if you use this funky quantum mechanical ability to search in different places simultaneously, then you can actually find it much faster. So if you have 100 pockets, classically it takes 50 tries, quantum mechanically it takes like something like 8 or 9. And if you have 1 million pockets, quantum mechanically it takes 1,000 tries. It goes as the square root of the number of pockets, which is a pretty cool thing. Can't possibly do this classically. So these guys, the Fleming group said, the bacteria, this exciton, when it's trying to go from here to there, is doing quantum search. It's like this is where the pocket, where the wallet is, and it looks in all these pockets simultaneously to find that there. Now, this is actually a very cool idea, that bacteria are performing quantum search. And the problem is that it's incorrect. This is not what bacteria are doing to get this exciton from here to there. But as soon as Alan Asper-Guzik and I looked at the problem, we realized that the bacteria are actually performing what's called a quantum walk. This is another kind of algorithm. And let me describe to you how it works. This should be more visual. So in a way, I already described to you what is a classical walk or a classical random walk. So if we have a random walk, I already described to you this picture that this exciton might be doing a classical random walk through this complex. And how does a classical random walk work? Well, it's like, you know, like imagine you've had too many Molsons, and you know, and you're trying to find your apartment door, and it's like, but you are not very clear on where it is, and like, you kind of like are wandering around left to right at random, and then it's like, oh, there it is, thank goodness, right? It takes a long time. Right, because in fact you're going this way as often as you're going that way, and you're gradually spreading out, but in fact it turns out you're only spreading out as the square root of the number of steps that you're going. So if your apartment is a long way away, you might never get there. Now, so a classical random walk, you take one random path, and it takes you a while to get where you're going. And I already told you that in the case of photosynthesis, that this is not good enough. So what about a quantum walk? Or a quantum random walk? In a quantum random walk, what happens is you don't just take one path, you take all possible paths at once through this complex. So you're not just taking one path, but many, many, many paths. But each of these paths can affect where you come. So you're not the actual probability of ending up at your destination is kind of a quantum sum of all the probabilities or probability amplitudes from all the different paths. Now, it turns out that these quantum random walks, a quantum random walk is much more efficient than a classical one. indeed, under the assumption that I could drink some quantum Molsons, all right, so I could take, in my drunken state, I could take all possible paths in some quantum mechanical sense from here to my apartment. I would just go like that. There it is. In you go. So quantum random walks have this feature that even though they look random, they're actually very efficient at getting from one place to another. And in fact, what Alan and I realized is if we were to describe this photosynthetic transfer process as a quantum walk, then photosynthesis can be very efficient if quantum walking is allowed. So in fact, these bacteria are actually doing a remarkably good job of using quantum effects in order to get this energy from where it's absorbed in this photosynthetic antenna, as it's called, over to the reaction center. And the reason is that it's performing a quantum walk. So bacteria discovered a particular kind of a quantum algorithm a long, long time ago. Yeah, it's like that. So if you think of a walk as a different path or a history, the question is this something like sum over histories? And one formulation of quantum mechanics is you sum over all possible classical histories, including crazy ones. Okay. But so it is something like that. There's a sum over all paths you could take, but you don't add up the probability of the paths. You add up their kind of quantum mechanical amplitude, their kind of quantumness. This is an important point of which I wish to get across. Are there questions at this point?
Do you have a question?
Yeah. Just yell it out.
Hello. The undersea vents you were mentioning before, are there IR photons available from the heat sources there?
So that's a very good question. So this process is some of these, there are IR photons, except those are very unlikely. Those are too low in energy to be absorbed and turned into excitons by these bacteria. These excitonic energies are around the order of an energy volt or something like that. So the IR photons won't cut it. However, these bacteria are found at undersea events that are miles, or I should say kilometers, below the surface of the ocean, where there's no light at all. And they still are somehow performing photosynthesis. So what's going on there? Can anybody tell me? Any physics-y people out there?
Quantum mechanics.
No, it's because even at down there, the water's still hot, why your question was a good one. The water's still hot, and that means that there's a tiny, tiny fraction of visible light photons in the black body radiation from this water. And that's enough for them still to get some happiness. Yeah, so that's a very good question. Another question? I've got a lot more to say, so don't worry. Yeah.
I mean, you're saying that it's a quantum walk, but how did you actually end up knowing for sure that it's a quantum walk?
Yeah, good question. So the question was, how do we know for sure it's a quantum walk? So let me tell you how we know for sure it's a quantum walk. So let me now actually I'm going to keep these purple bacteria here for a bit. Let me turn to this original paper, which is about green sulfur bacteria. And let me actually tell you what we did and what the experiment was. So in these green sulfur bacteria, by the way, in case you think these things are rare, green sulfur bacteria and purple sulfur bacteria make up something like 40% of the biomass on the planet. So, and all that green stuff out there is also doing very similar kinds of things. So it's not just like, you know, they're just like a few of these dudes hanging out at hot sea vents looking for some action. So the way this works is up here, there's a huge cylinder. Well, it's not huge, it's like a micron in size, but huge compared with this other stuff. There's this thing called the chlorosome, which is the antenna where the exciton, the photon is absorbed and the exciton is created. And the reaction center is down here, and then there's this thing called, you know, you see, if you this is you, if you want a better picture, go to Google Images. The FMO complex, or Fenner-Myers-Olson complex. And what the Fleming group had observed was coherent sloshing back and forth, a so-called quantum tunneling, or quantum beating, of an exciton moving back and forth between these two sites right here. So each of these is a place where an exciton can live. There's seven of them. And somehow the exciton has got to get for this, you know, this E plus minus has got from up here through the center and down to the reaction center. Okay? So it's kind of a communications channel for sending. This big, huge thing up here is huge. These things are 1,000 times smaller. There's a lot of them and a lot of reaction centers. But the experimental evidence was that this quantum sloshing back and forth was going there. Now, this system, it's amazing. Photosynthesis is an amazingly well-studied field. It goes back for many decades. It's what I call a grumpy old man field because, well, well, it's one of those fields that, like, you know, where, you know, how Stanislav Ulam said, you know, it's well known that that science precedes one death at a time. But this is a field where it's kind of like, you know, and to make progress in your own field, the only way is for you to die yourself. That's like the best way to make progress. When I said that at a conference of these people, they didn't think that was very funny. I mean, these are guys like that, you know, it's so grumpy that when we wrote our papers, which are extremely well cited, I shouldn't say who did this. Okay, somebody when they wrote a follow-up paper, and the person who wrote the paper came to our lab at MIT and said, I loved your paper so much. Your papers were so important to me. I read them many, many times in order to understand them and to write this paper. So we said, well, why didn't you reference our paper in your reference list then? It seems sort of strange. That's kind of the signature of grumpy old man fields. Okay, but this system, the quantum mechanics of this system is known extremely precisely. So the energies of the excitons, as they sit on these different chromophores, color-carrying or exciton-carrying systems, the energies of these excitons is known to a high degree of accuracy. The rate at which an exciton can hop coherently from one place to another is known very accurately. And the structure of the environment, these things are actually embedded in some protein skeleton, the structure of this environment is also known to a high degree of accuracy. So we were able to make a quantum mechanical model that used no free parameters. So all the parameters in the model were taken from experiment. And then we investigated the behavior of this model. The only parameter that we could vary was the temperature. Okay? So we investigated, now, so this is exactly the kind of model where things will take these quantum walks. And the quantum walk can be helped or destroyed. It can be destroyed by the presence of disorder in the system, and also destroyed by environmental interactions. So we did a zero free parameter calculation, and we looked at the following graph. So as a function of temperature, this is zero down here, we looked at the efficiency. And then we also looked at the time it took to traverse this, okay? So I'm gonna make efficiency in blue and time in red. And then I'm going to draw a graph. I hope that's okay. By the way, I don't have a watch. Do you know how much? I'm okay. How much? 10 minutes? Okay, great. Perfect. I will not say everything I was going to say about bacteria because I want to talk about at least I smell a quantum. Okay. So now, most of my collaborators on this, by the way, are Alan Asper-Gusick at Harvard, my postdoc, who was then with Alan, Masood Mohseni, who is actually the person who really did this stuff, you know, how to, like, the professors sit around and, like, get their bacteria, I mean, their graduate students to go and, and do the hard work. Hey, you know, gajillions of bacteria undergoing natural selection can find out all kinds of things that, you know, hundreds of graduate students will never find out. So, and this is the case with these bacteria, right? So, okay, so I predicted that because of disorder in the energies of the molecules, these these excitons would undergo something that's called localization, which is that these paths, instead of interfering positively to get them to the end, would interfere destructively and they just get stuck. So for low temperatures, my prediction was this wouldn't be very efficient. Then, as the environmental interactions kicked in, it would gradually destroy this process and the system would be doing a semi-coherent quantum walk, kind of like mixing the regular Molson with the quantum Molson, semi-coherent quantum walk through this structure, and then the efficiency would go up. But then, if the environment was whacking at this thing too hard, then this evil thing, quantum thing called decoherence, where all your quantumness goes away, would kick in, and the efficiency would drop to zero. And that's exactly what happened. It starts off at around 3/4 at zero temperature. It goes up and up and up and up and up and up. It reaches 100%. So one. There's a rather broad plateau, which it stays in one, and then it drops down to zero. And even more interesting than this was the time it took. I'll plot this on a different axis over here. At 0 degrees, the time was around 100 picoseconds, 100 trillionths of a second. These processes take very short time, which is why they can remain quantum mechanical even in these hot, wet conditions. The time started way up there, and then it dipped way down, and then it got down 5 picoseconds, actually, sorry, it was about roughly the same point, and then it goes up to infinity there. So the thing was stuck at low temperatures, then this subtle interplay or interaction between environmental effects and coherent effects kicked in, and then it got extremely efficient and just zipped through this complex. And then when it got too hot, bad things started to happen again. And by the way, what do you think that this critical temperature is right here, where this is at a maximum? It's over a rather broad range of many tens of degrees, Kelvin or Celsius, right? But what do you think that temperature is? Somebody give me a guess, come on. Yeah, it's like 290 Kelvin, which is room temperature, or kind of the temperature that these bacteria are seeing down there, which again shows you that, it shows you God is a great quantum mechanical engineer. So she is just awesome. She knows what she's doing really well. or of course, trillions of bacteria didn't die in vain. There, yeah. So the evidence we have for this, we modeled it as a quantum walk. We had zero free parameters in this, and we found this remarkable, not just merely what we expected, which is the thing would work well, but we found that it fit beautifully with our theories of how the interaction with coherence and decoherence from the environment should play out. Okay? And these models have now been established by lots of other people. Lots more experiments have been done. This kind of coherence of these quantum effects is very well established. So this use of bacteria of quantum coherence and quantum hanky-panky is really nailed down. I mean, some people might disagree with it, but I've never met anybody who'd actually looked at the evidence who actually disagreed with it. Okay, so are there more questions about bacteria? I want to move on to a couple of these other things right here. You can always ask some questions later, but do we have a question back there?
Yes.
Yeah.
Does this suggest another way of building a quantum computer?
There are lots of these living systems have lots of lessons to teach us in quantum computation. So, in quantum computation, the interaction with the environment is a killer, and we have to go through extreme measures to get rid of it, but in these bacteria, the interaction with the environment, as you can see from this graph, is very well tuned to give you both high efficiencies at your operating temperatures and robustness, so a wide range of operating temperatures around there. So these bacteria have done an excellent job at dealing with environmental interactions, much better job than we do on quantum computers by and large. Of course, in some sense, it's actually for people who here do quantum computation, it's easier to protect energy from decaying than it is to protect quantum information from going away. But in fact, I think there is in these purple bacteria, let me actually tell you, I'm going to tell you a little bit more about this because this is something I'm doing right now. These purple bacteria, so there's a kind of a double ring structure. So I actually claim these purple bacteria are using a very sophisticated quantum coding scheme. The outer ring has, I won't be able to draw it right there, there are 18 of these. These are these chromophores where the energy can sit. The inner ring has 9. I'll tell you what these little X's look like just in a second. From the side, it looks kind of like a teeny nuclear power plant cooling tower, about 7 angstroms, 0.7 nanometers wide by, no, sorry, 7 nanometers wide by 6 nanometers tall. So, and these things are all arranged in a big array. Now, if you look at one of these little dot, these little X's right here, this is a chromophore. It's a funny kind of like square-shaped molecule, and it's got a kind of tails going off here, and it's got some other junk here, all of which can be varied by natural selection. And the exciton gets created basically, I think, along this axis. I can't remember exactly. And then it jiggles around, and it relaxes, so at the end, it's along this axis. So and it, then it's in a very, so it starts along this axis, the diagonal one, it ends up along that axis. Now, this exciton is in an entangled state where the spins of the electron and hole are in opposite directions. And this entangled state, it's called a singlet state for those who are interested in that kind of thing, it has the feature that is effectively what's called in quantum mechanics a decoherence-free subspace, which is something that basically doesn't interact directly with the environment. It's what gives the exciton its really long lifetime. Now, if you don't want like the words decoherence-free subspace, which I wouldn't blame you for not liking, you can just say, you know, the bacteria don't give a damn what they call it, right? They found something that worked, and that something has worked is what egg-heady people like me call a decoherence-free subspace. Now, this exciton is, so this is in this funky state, so there's this one level of quantum coding at the most microscopic level that keeps the exciton alive for a very long time, for several nanoseconds, which is a darn long time for an exciton. The cool feature now is that when you look at where this exciton lives on this ring, it doesn't live in one place. It's actually in some weird quantum superposition of being everywhere at once. Right? It's not in one place. It's like all over this ring. Now, this state has the feature that if I look at a neighboring ring over here, because it's in this symmetric state around this ring, this state is coupled by a factor of 18 more strongly to this other ring. So it can hop 18 times faster. Actually, it's even better than that, because if I look at the exciton to exciton hopping time, it's 18 squared times faster. So this is so the bacteria is using quantum coding at this level to preserve the excitonic energy. And then at this higher level, it's using this other form of quantum coding, the symmetric state, to enhance the transfer rate from one ring to another. And this is what's called a concatenated quantum code. Concatenated quantum code. A concatenated code, you know, you can have one code that's good protecting against one form of error, and another kind of code which is good at correcting against another form of error, and when you pop the two together, then you get a concatenated code. So you use this here, you're using protection against dissipation at the smallest level, and then enhancement of transfer at this next level. So bacteria, not only did they discover like some quantum computing techniques, they also discovered very sophisticated quantum coding techniques. Now that I wrote this down, you know, when I start saying things like decoherence-free subspace and concatenated quantum code, I realize that I've gone too far. So let's move on. I'm just blown away by the fact that this is the case. You know, that not only are these bacteria doing some kind of rudimentary quantum computation and using kind of rudimentary techniques, they're using extremely sophisticated quantum information techniques that folks in this room only discovered in the last 10 years. And Raymond Laflamme is one of those people. So, no, maybe he doesn't agree anyway, okay. So given that I'm running short on time, I have 5 minutes left, is that right? Okay. So I'm gonna skip the avian compass and the avian bird brain. Suffice it to say that, oh. Okay, I'll tell you about it. Do I get some leeway? They've been asking all these good questions, which you know, could be thought of as part of the question time. Okay, so the Avian Compass. So now, I should say the next two examples, Avian Compass and I Smell Quantum, the evidence is circumstantial. With a photosynthesis, not only do we have strong evidence that it's going on, which is the very great efficiency of photosynthetic transport, we also know the quantum structures of these systems extremely accurately. We can simulate them extremely accurately. So this is, and the experiments can probe their quantum behavior very accurately. So the photosynthesis stuff, the role of quantum mechanics is very nailed down. For these other two that I'm going to describe, we don't know the actual mechanism. But what is going on is that there are forms of behavior that we observe in animals, in birds, animals, and even in human beings that cannot be explained by any other known mechanism other than quantum mechanics. I mean, there might be some classical version, but nobody knows. So I'll do this like Sherlock Holmes way. I'll present you the evidence, and then I'll give you the explanation, because the evidence is really weird in both of these cases. So, Avian Compass. Well, you know, it's been known for a long time. In fact, my father's college roommate did this experiment, that pigeons, homing pigeons, have a piece of magnetite in their beak. And this allows them to sense the direction of the Earth's magnetic field, just because they can feel the force on this magnetite as they move it around, right? This would be kind of a fun thing to have oneself, though. I guess not if you're in the presence of a superconducting magnet, right? So we won't take you to Dave Corey's lab. But there are other birds, like the European robin, which is the one on most of the observations have been made, that are also able to sense the Earth's magnetic field, but not by the same mechanism. And here's the evidence. Okay. The European robin, and they do these experiments by taking the robins while they're migrating, so they want to go south, okay? The experiments are done in Hamburg, so they really want to go south. And they put them in these cone-shaped cages, and then they take the lid off and they see which direction they fly. And you can subject them to different magnetic fields, you can subject them to oscillating magnetic fields and light, all of which is important. So here's the evidence. Number one, the robins can tell the orientation of the field, but not whether it's north or south. I guess actually the field here, that's north, right? So the field here goes something like that. And the North Pole is down that way, south is up that. The robins can tell that it's going like that, but they can't tell if it's North Pole or South Pole. In the Southern Hemisphere, this is actually okay, because in the Southern Hemisphere, you still know how to commute or migrate in the right direction, right? But they know the angle, that it's coming out of the ground, and that's very important, because that means they know their latitude. So they know both the direction, though not north or south, and their latitude. So it's good. In the winter in the Northern Hemisphere, they go south. In the winter in the Southern Hemisphere, they go north. So everything is copacetic. OK. So that's weird, because that's not like an ordinary magnet. Homing pigeons can tell north from south. Okay. Secondly, they can only tell the direction of the Earth's magnetic field when they're subjected to blue or green light. That's really weird. I mean, in fact, before the invention of fluorescent lights, they couldn't figure out what was going on because they were had incandescent lights in where the robins were, so they couldn't figure it out. That's bizarre. Thirdly, if you subject them to a rapidly oscillating electromagnetic field at like a million times a second, they get totally disoriented. This is pretty wacky. So the only explanation that people have been able to come up with for this is purely quantum mechanical explanation. Again, it has to do with the absorption of light. A photon comes in. The photon has sufficient energy, and that's why it has to be blue or green, because blue or green photons have higher energy than red photons. It has sufficient energy to excite what's called a free radical pair, two electrons, okay? They get excited in some molecule. We don't know what the molecule is. Now, they're in an entangled state. Entanglement is this funky quantum mechanical effect, like one electron can be here and there at the same time. Entangled means like if you have two electrons, they'd be here, here, and there, there at the same time. These electrons are in a funky quantum mechanical entangled state, which is exquisitely sensitive to the orientation of the Earth's magnetic field, but not to whether it's north or south. Then, the rate at which these spins of the electrons rotate is proportional to the strength of the Earth's magnetic field, and because also to its orientation. And so the idea is that once they've rotated by a certain amount, this electron can take off, start current flowing somewhere else, and if you've got 10,000 of these things going, then you have enough current to set up a neural signal in the brain, and then the bird brain can figure out which direction is north or south. This is the only model that people may be able to come up with that actually fits the experimental detail or observed details. But I should say, it's not anywhere near as nailed down as if we knew the exact molecules, which people are searching for even as we speak. There, I talked about quantum bird brains. Yeah, question.
How do they perceive that the light? What mechanism do they?
Do they perceive?
You're saying, is it a normal?
So the way they would see this, right, is you have a neural signal that's proportional. So it's if your orientation is, this free radical probably sits in some molecule. The molecule is orientable. The molecules maybe sit around the inside of the eye of the bird. And so the strength of the signal depends on where these molecules, how they're oriented with respect to the Earth's magnetic field. So let's say if they're head on like that, they see the largest signal, and then as they move aside, they see less. So what the bird would then see would be kind of like this increasing brightness from these molecules in that's where the brightest spot is located along the axis which the Earth's magnetic field points. That's the idea. And actually, if human beings have this mechanism, which maybe we do, been buried somewhere in our DNA, I definitely want it. I don't trust that GPS. Even though I've written papers on quantum GPS. So, yeah. Okay. So let me, in the interest, because I don't want to make Greg unhappy, let me move on to the final topic, which is I smell a quantum. And the guy to look up here again about this is Luca Turin. So, here, what is the evidence here? Well, there's a very good, you know, for a long time, people thought that it was a perfectly good classical theory of smell. So Linus Pauling in the 1940s said, hey, look, you know, we have a receptor, and we have an odorant, which is a smelly molecule, right? And the molecule has a particular shape, and it will only lock into receptors that have the right shape to receive it, a so-called lock and key mechanism, which is everywhere in biological systems. And so each smell that we can sense corresponds to one particular type of receptor being stimulated. Now, this is known. There are indeed these receptors inside the nose. There are something, I think, 387 different kinds. I'm not getting the number exactly right. So they're all known. They're known to be roughly 400 different types. So everything seemed fine, and everything seemed fine for decades. But there is a problem. The first problem is that even human beings who have a rotten sense of smell can smell up to 10,000 different kinds of scents. So not just 373, right? So that's sort of weird. The second weird piece of evidence is that if you take an organic molecule and you replace one of the carbons by silicon, which you can do because it has the same chemical valence structure. So any compound where you have a carbon molecule, you can always put a silicon molecule, any compound where you have a carbon atom, you can always replace the carbon atom by a silicon atom and have a viable chemical structure. So you take one of these big organic molecules and you take something that's not at the business end of the molecule, the lock end, the key end of the molecule, and you replace that carbon by a silicon atom. And now I'm going to try to channel Luca Turin, who's a very charming gentleman. And he worked for many years as a smellologist, I mean an odorologist, for the perfume companies. He and his wife wrote a book cataloging 10,000 different scents. And as you can imagine, if you're a smellologist, it's kind of like a wine snob, right? That you have to have different, for that many scents, you have to have different ways of describing them. So here is the way Luca describes this particular experiment. The organic molecule with the carbon has a fresh, sharp, grassy, slightly fruity smell like a fine New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. Maybe from the north of Marlborough. Whereas the molecule that has silicon in it smells like rotten eggs. Now, how could that be? Because they're binding to the same receptors, and yet they smell entirely different. So here's the theory. The theory is that I'm not going to draw pictures of this because we don't have time. Also, like, too many graphs is too much. So here's the theory. The theory is that somehow it's not just the chemical structure of the molecule that makes it smell a certain way. It's also the vibrational frequency of the molecule, the rate at which it wiggles back and forth, okay? Now, silicon molecules are a lot heavier than carbon. Silicon atoms, excuse me, I've been talking too much. Silicon atoms are a lot heavier than carbon atoms. And so if you take a carbon atom and replace it by silicon, then it's going to wiggle back and forth more slowly. If you look at this vibrational spectrum, the rate at which this molecule with the silicon vibrates, you find that it's very, very similar in its frequency to the rate at which sulfur compounds vibrate. And as we all know, sulfur smells like rotten eggs. Okay? So the idea is that somehow it's the vibrational frequency that's important, as well as this lock and key mechanism. Now, that's actually pretty strange, because we don't know of chemical mechanisms that allow you to distinguish between vibrational frequencies. The only kinds of mechanisms we know that allow you to distinguish between them is if you have something where, for instance, an electron's coming through this, the molecule locks into the receptor. Electron is trying to get through, but it doesn't have the right energy to do its quantum, funky quantum thing and do this quantum tunneling through this molecule. It can only do it if it picks up a phonon, a particle of sound. Remember, anything with on at the end is like a particle, elementary quantum particle. Like for this talk, we should have an Amaron be a love particle, right? So hanky-panky on. So as the electron is trying to tunnel, it can't get there unless it picks up a vibration of a particular frequency from this molecule. And only if it picks up a phonon of the right frequency or energy can it make it through and then start electrical current flowing. So, I mean, it sounds implausible, but that's the only mechanism people have been able to think of. And there are actually nice theoretical papers that model how this works, and it should work extremely well and very efficiently. Because these kind of quantum, what's is called phonon-assisted tunneling, and phonon-assisted tunneling can be a very efficient process for turning currents on and off. So let me just tell you the final bit of evidence about this. So the real evidence that you'd like about this, for this effect, is to see not if people can tell the difference when you change a carbon for a silicon, which, yeah, maybe there's some chemical thing going on. It could be. We don't know, all right? But suppose you take every hydrogen atom in this carbon, in this organic molecule, and you exchange it for a deuterium atom, which weighs twice as much, but is chemically identical to hydrogen. Okay? Now, this molecule, the one with the heavy hydrogen, is now chemically absolutely identical to the original molecule. There's no chemical process that can distinguish between these. However, its vibrational frequencies are very different because, again, the deuterium atoms are vibrating, wiggling back and forth half as fast, roughly, as the hydrogen atoms. So let's take the same compound that we had before, the one that smells like, a fine Marlboro short Sauvignon Blanc, and let's change the hydrogens to deuteriums and see if people can tell the difference. Well, the answer is that people are not very good at telling the difference. But on the other hand, people are not very good at smells anyway. If you think of this, there's a natural selection reasoning for this. Like, for something like dogs, smell is very important, or fruit flies, which we'll get to in just a second. You've got to smell different kinds of decaying fruit, right? But for human beings over the last tens of thousands of years have been crammed together in tiny, unsanitary cities where all kinds of hideous smells were all the time. And the people who said, oh my God, this is too good, I just can't take it, they went off into the desert and died. I'm serious. Come on. There's got to be a reason why human beings are so bad at smelling stuff, and that's my guess. All right. Okay. So, but fruit flies have an exquisite sense of smell. Like, they could, if they were your wine tasters, they could tell the difference between any of these wines. They actually, they're receptors, scent receptors, are on their front legs. Their nose is on their knees, right? And so they can smell. They have an amazing sense of smell. They also have the great virtue that they're not subject to federal regulations about animal experiments, and which I'm told is an important thing. And they all have an even better virtue, which is that you can, if you send 30 euros to this place in Austria, they'll sell you, by the next week, you'll get this box containing 10,000 genetically identical fruit flies. So you don't have to worry about whether there, you know, some genetic variation amongst them that's causing your problems. So you do the following experiments. This experiment has now been done. Actually, it's not been published, but I think I'm allowed to tell you the results of it. So you have the fruit flies in a container, and from this side, scent, you know, the natural scent is seeping in, and from that side, the deuterated heavy hydrogen scent is seeping in. And if the fruit flies wander over to the natural scent side, you zap them with an electrical wire, and they really don't like that. Right. You can see it would be difficult to do this with human experiment and human subjects. Yeah. So, okay. Now, you take away the wire and you start mixing up. Oh, and by the way, you zap them with this. After a while, all of them are over with this other set, except for the few masochistic fruit flies over on that side. So, they're all over with the heavy hydrogen set. Now you remove the zapping mechanism. And you start mixing up which direction these scents are coming from, and you find, lo and behold, you know, out to 6 sigma, actually 8 sigma, it's like 99.99% of the time, the fruit flies always go to the heavy hydrogen scent. Always. They're like, they've had enough of the natural one, they know what's gonna happen, forget it. They actually kind of, over the course of several days, they forget this and are back for more punishment. But but if you do it in the same day, you know, their memories are good enough that they never go in that direction. So the evidence is very strong that fruit flies, at any rate, can distinguish between molecules not by their chemical composition, but by their vibrational spectrum. And again, the only mechanism that people have been able to think of for how this could work is an intrinsically quantum mechanical one with phonon-assisted tunneling. So Greg is looking kind of antsy over there. So let me just wrap up here. So Well, it's pretty clear that it's certainly in the case of photosynthesis, the thing that gives us life from the sun, for sun life. Sorry, there's my product placement once again. I wasn't paid by Molson, though. So sun and life gives us photosynthesis. And photosynthesis has now, over the last 3.5 years, has been clearly established as relying intrinsically on effects like quantum coherence. On top of that, these photosynthetic bacteria, and I haven't talked about green plants, but green plants have a similar story. These photosynthetic bacteria are using highly sophisticated techniques, which us quantum computing types would say, wow, look at that, that's a decoherence-free subspace, or wow, look at that, it's a concatenated quantum code. The bacteria just say, wow, look at that, I can have more babies, right? So they don't care what they call it. They don't even care if it's quantum or not. They don't know from quantum mechanics, right? So so they have discovered these very sophisticated quantum coding techniques and quantum transport techniques and techniques of using quantum algorithms in order to enhance their efficiency at reproduction. In this case, you're just enhancing their efficiency at bringing in energy. But in fact, if you make mutant bacteria where you start turning off some of these things, so actually, in this picture, the right hat of this quantum coding. If you go and mess with this chromophore, like changing using genetic knockout techniques to change these things right here, you find that you can change, for instance, the absorption rates. You can lower the absorption rates. Not surprisingly, the natural one has very high absorption rates. You can lower the lifetimes. Or by changing the structure here to make it less symmetric or symmetric in the wrong ways, you can decrease the bacteria's efficiency reproduction by so much that within the course of 30 or 40 generations, they've all reverted to the wild type. So these quantum effects are very important for these bacteria for reproduction. Then we have these things like the avian compass and I smell a quantum, the quantum mechanics of smell, were very strong circumstantial evidence in terms of animal or fruit fly human back behavior and avian behavior, bird brains, shows that something really funny is going on. And when you put on your Sherlock Holmes hat and try to figure out, well, what could be going on, the only mechanisms that fit in with the evidence are that these things are up to some serious quantum hanky-panky. So, and I haven't mentioned things like, you know, light, which is another mechanism why we sense stuff. We believe, by we, I mean Alan Asper-Guzik, Masood Masani, and I, we believe that we can show that in the absorption of individual photons, that the same kind of quantum hanky-panky is going on. In this case, the interaction between quantum coherence and environment in order to make this process extremely efficient. Actually, detection of light is so efficient that our brains can sense individual photons coming in. It actually turns out to be too efficient. And what happens is, even though a rod or cone cell will fire when it receives an individual photon, there's actually a suppression mechanism down the optic nerve which suppresses a signal to our brain unless we see like 5 to 10 photons. And the reason for that is the same reason that these bacteria can photosynthesize in the dark, which is that if we saw every photon, then even when it's completely dark out, we'd still be seeing all these flashes of light from just the heat, the black body radiation around. Actually, it turns out that frogs do not have the suppression mechanism, which might explain something about their behavior. I don't know. So I think it's a remarkable thing, this field of quantum life, quantum hanky-panky, plants and bacteria and birds and fruit flies and maybe even human beings using quantum effects in order to make life more livable, have more offspring, to do the natural selection kind of thing. And my suspicion is that as we look closer into the action of biological systems, we'll find that it's quantum hanky-panky all the way down. So, I'll thank you there.
Thank you very much. We'd like to open the floor now to questions.
For the photosynthesis model, you said that all of the, like the, what you did on the computer, you said it has, you know, all of the limitations, but is the acceptor site always in the same spot for the random walk?
I'm quite sure, maybe I was exaggerating when I say everything was known, because actually it's not true that everything is known. But so what is known about these systems is the shape of each, the chemical identity of each of the chromophores, its shape, the orientation, its orientation, which tells you where its dipole is oriented, the form of the protein skeleton in which they sit. This is all evidence from X-ray crystallography. You crystallize these structures, and you can map them out down to the angstrom level of where all the atoms sit. So the one thing, indeed the reaction center, I believe, is located just at a particular point on every single one of these. However, there may be the one parameter in which there may be some variation which has not been completely determined experimentally is the rate of that final hop from the FMO complex into the reaction center. However, we found out that our results were robust against having a wide variation of that parameter. So, yes, I lied to you, but that's what science is about. Believe me, it wasn't as bad as some lies I could tell.